There's a story at the time of the Buddha of a monk named Sona. Can you hear me back there? Okay, yeah, okay. And Sona had come from a kind of well-off family and had been inspired to take robes as a monk and live this wandering, simple, holy life in pursuit of the liberation of heart that he was so moved to see in others. And so he came to practice with just incredible determination and diligence and effort. But it was really out of balance. And so they, you know, the story is that he just was like pushing so hard and, you know, striving so hard in his practice that even in walking meditation, his feet were cut and kind of blistered and bloody from just this kind of relentless and intense walking meditation he was doing. And at some point, sort of worn out, exhausted, frustrated, sort of doubtful, he thought to himself, he said, gosh, I don't know if this is worth it. You know, he's like, I could go back home and just kind of live a life of ease and give donations to the monastery. And, you know, that'd be good to do. And the Buddha, who could sort of sense these things, you know, kind of tuned in and that this moment of doubt was happening. And so he got there and he showed up to talk to Sona, and he said to him, he said, what do you think, Sona? Before, when you were a householder, were you skilled at playing the lute? Yes, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were too taut, was your luna in tune? Your lute? Here, they're calling it a vina, so I'm trying to do that in my head. Was your lute in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were too loose, was your lute in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were neither too taut nor too loose, but tuned to be right on pitch, was your lute tuned and playable? Yes, Lord. In the same way, Sona, over-aroused persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. Thus, you should determine the right pitch for your persistence, attuned to the pitch of the five faculties of the senses, and there pick up your theme. Yes, Lord. And so after that, the Venerable Sona determined the right pitch for his persistence, attuned to the pitch of the five faculties, and there picked up his theme. Dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute, he in no time at all reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life, for which people go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself here and now. And thus the Venerable Sona became another one of the arahants, this word used to describe a fully enlightened being. And I think there's something. You just think of a story of, you know, 2,600 years ago that actually can resonate so much with where we are in our lives right now and our determination for practice. You know, I know that for many folks here, that this is like their first attempt at doing a longer retreat, you know, to be doing this kind of diligent practice for a whole day, a few days, you know, overnight, to be in silence in this kind of space. And I know that place in myself of being like, wow, like, I feel so good after sitting for 20 minutes. Like, imagine how good I'll feel after sitting for a whole day, you know? And then really, like, that honest, like, you know, how are you feeling right now? You know, it's like, it's incredible, actually, how hard this is, you know, how much work it can be to be here. And confusing, you know, like, why is it so exhausting? Why is it so frustrating? Why is it so kind of sometimes doubt-inducing? Why is it so confusing? It's definitely something you have to do to kind of understand the challenges of it. You know, there's folks back home who think you're out, like, getting massages or something, you know, and it's like, oh, God, like, you know, and then you try to explain to them, like, what was so hard, and it's like, oh, whatever, you know, I couldn't stop thinking about something, or, you know, just these sort of, like, little dramas we have during the day that, like, don't translate, really, you know, people don't quite get what is it that's so hard about just some wanting or some loneliness or some aversion to an itch, you know, that can start to feel like the whole world is consumed by it. Just how humbling the practice is. But that, like, that's it's doing its work, you know, this grind of, you know, there's that place of, you know, we have to get a taste of the goodness that the practice can bring, of that sense of relief during our days where it's like, gosh, there's something after we sit that can feel so like a fog is cleared in our lives, you know, and that there's some kind of rest or some kind of relaxation. We get kind of a whiff of something more free. And then when we come to practice for a longer period, you know, we have to take into account that it's like, we're not just going to be getting these high points all day long, right? It's not like we're just kind of hitting peak experience after peak experience. It's designed against that. It's designed to make us go through all of life, right? Not to avoid sleepiness and restlessness and worry and doubt and aversion and wanting. It's not like we just sort of somehow manage to kind of get away from all of that. It's designed to, you know, we're sitting, walking through the whole day. So there's just going to be natural places of more energy or less energy, more resistance, less resistance. More willingness, more enthusiasm, less willingness, less enthusiasm. This reality that we start to see that we are, the heart mind is constantly bombarded with experience out of our control, right? This flood of sense experience and seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, the body. It's like all of these out of our control. We can manipulate, we can tinker. But for the most part, you know, there's a flood of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience arising and passing on its own. And it's overwhelming for the mind at times. The sense of, God, how do we manage this flood? And we start to see, oh, the way that we manage it is by tuning out, right? Getting sleepy, distracting ourselves, entertaining ourselves, the sort of techniques of delusion that we have. We have ways of grasping towards pleasure, you know, pleasant experience, pleasurable experience, to help kind of solidify a connection with that which is, you know, which feels good. We have aversion towards unpleasant experience as this way of defending against that which is unpleasant, that which feels threatening or harmful. And so you can see that these tendencies in the heart of, you know, we call them, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. They're treated as like these, the big enemies, you know, the things we need to overcome. But really, if you watch and you listen closely to the heart, you see that they're defenses, right? They're defenses against the overwhelm, and that they're totally understandable. It's like, of course we're overwhelmed by this flood, and of course we're going to grab on to pleasant experience. Of course we're going to run away from unpleasant. Of course we're going to space out and tune out and dull the mind to whatever degree we can when it feels too intense. So it's not like some pathology, right? It's like you have to see, you know, you look at the animal kingdom and it's like, God, we've been evolving to run from that which is trying to eat us and get that which is going to help us reproduce and or survive, you know, and like not deal with the stuff that just like can't fit into our little, you know, chipmunk brains. That this is like, we're the inheritors of billions of years of doing that. And it's like, it's beautiful. You know, that's, it's helped us survive. It's helped us survive beyond what we can remember, but it's surely helped us survive in our own lifetime. Places of anger, places of defensiveness, places of trying to get something pleasant to make us feel like we can make it through. And yet, where are the places where it also creates dissonance, where we also see that it's, that these patterns aren't ultimately liberating, right? That they can kind of soothe us for periods of time and they can put, keep some stuff at bay, but that ultimately they're faulty tools, right? That ultimately we're not going to always just be able to keep conjuring pleasant. We're not always going to be able to keep unpleasant away. We can't always stay tuned out from experience, from life. And so we also see that we dig in patterns that are denial, that are aversive, that are violent, that are addictive. And so we come to try to understand the heart and mind and try to build this other training, build the sense of where do we have the capacity to be with reality as it is. And where is that a very painful stretching? Where is it a beautiful stretching? Where is there something at times where we feel so capable of being with something that might otherwise be hard? And so that thing about like Sona, you know, from wherever we come in our lives to be inspired and to show up for the practice and then, you know, at times be really ground down by it, really just humbled by it. And where is that dance between being humbled and being, you know, in despair or feeling like helpless or feeling like we're so much doubt that we don't feel capable of it? And how do we keep our sense of buoyancy? And some of it has to do with this fine-tuning of the attention, this carefulness of like, gosh, maybe we're actually pushing too hard at times, you know, trying to get something, trying to be super concentrated, trying to be the perfect yogi. Maybe we're too lax at other times, and it feels like we're not really, you know, putting in the effort that it's going to take to really, the courageous effort that it takes to show up for this. I think it was, you know, as someone who, you know, I resonate with these music metaphors, and I think that there's, to me, there's something amazing about, it was very late in life when, as a person who had music in my life as since a child, I always still had this idea of like, oh, the voice is not, is there's like the singer and then there's the band, right? There's like the voice and then the instruments. And it wasn't for a long time that I really understood that it's like, oh no, the voice is an instrument, right? That actually people learn to play the voice, that they learn to play the body in this particular way to make a sound. And that it was something around through that that helped me realize that the mind is also an instrument, right? That we're in this practice, there is a way that we can relate to it as an instrument, relate to it as this, you know, beautiful and complex thing that we might not have a lot of skill with at this point. We might not have a lot of relationship with or understanding it in those terms. But that actually, if we start to relate to the practice of the mind as we would the practice of Sona's lute or another instrument, there is actually a lot to be gained from that. I think just about 2 years ago, I started trying to learn how to play the violin, and it continues to be very humbling. It's, you know, I have played different instruments in my life, none to performability on any scale. But this was really different, to really have an instrument that didn't just sound right when you just play it. Like a piano, it's like you hit the key and there's the tone, you know? And if it's out of tune, it's not your fault. It's like you have to tune the thing. And with the violin, it's like, God, there's no frets. There's just like this string. And the smallest difference in where your finger is like this world of difference in terms of how offensive your presence is, you know. And it's amazing, you know, this but I just, I there's something so, for me, so, and I do feel like it's like this practice of meditation has helped me really value the part, the period of time that can be really unending of feeling bad at something, but that you still want to keep doing it, right? And that like most of the violin practice is like pretty much being bad at it, you know? And yet somehow you have to make that feel like joyous, you know? Like there has to be some enough in there that you're feeling like, oh, you're still interested, you're still intrigued, there's still like some hope, you know, that you'll just land that note at some point, you know? Because sometimes it gets there, you know? And sometimes it's a little squiggling and you kind of work it out. But I think there's something about the this practice that's very similar of just like, just that sense of we're so trained to like be good at things and to be proud of the things we're good at. And it gets harder and harder, I think, perhaps as we get older to be willing to start things freshly, you know, and to just be really feel like we're bad at it and feel like we're totally lost and bewildered and not know. And to be that kind of humble and to have that feel rewarding versus humiliating, you know. Like I, now it's 2 years in a row, I haven't made that much progress. I'm, I have to go, you know, I go to this teacher whenever I'm home, you know, I kind of go to her a couple times a month and I'll, I just, this last Christmas, I had my second, you know, recital and it's just me and like 30 little kids, you know. Some are a little bit older, you know, there's like a couple teenagers and they're like super good, right? And then there's me and like these, there's this little 4-year-old who I feel like is like my rival, you know. And he's always in his little tuxedo and so, you know, he's keeping me going, you know. I have this, there's a little competition there. I think is kind of helpful. But that willingness to just be like a grown up, you know, in like a room full of kids who are better than you for the most part, you know, and just crank it out and just try. It's like, you know, Frosty the Snowman. There's something still so kind of joyous about it for me that I enjoy, that it's good, that feels good and feels wholesome and still feels like learning, you know, and is grounding. And I think there's something about being in a space of shared learning where age, you know, doesn't matter and all these other things, you know. I mean, it's Hawaii and it's like very diverse in many ways anyway. So there's just like a lot of sense of that sort of like, there's not kind of like, who's the grown-up? You know, it's kind of like, oh, everyone's sort of just learning. And there's a beauty to that that I think is like so welcoming. There's a very kind of, there's a deep intergenerational ethic of culture and space there that feels very nourishing, I think, for young and old and everyone in between. Part of what for me has really helped with the violin is something I really feel like I've learned in this practice where, you know, we have a method, right? There's a tradition, a lineage that we're part of that offers a very kind of classical technical approach to the practice. And it is very beautiful and it's so powerful. And it's also not the only way to practice, right? And so I think like for myself with the violin, it's like my teacher is she has me mostly playing classical music. And it's not the music like that I'm most drawn to. It's not not just the music, but the approach. It's just like very technical. And there's a lot of precision that is like very much highly regarded. And I realized for myself that like there is something amazing about it, and there's such important learning in terms of some of the like technical and precise training. And if I practice like that all the time, I would go crazy, right? I just like couldn't handle it because I don't enjoy it enough to put myself through that, right? So it's like I need to find a balance of trying to do a kind of a little dose of the sort of classical traditional method and seeing how hard it is and appreciating it, but not doing so much that it's overwhelming me and making me feel like I can't do it. And then spending enough time practicing songs that I'm kind of feel more connected to, right? In a way that's much more relaxed and less interested in the sort of perfection of it, but in the heart quality of it, right? And in the kind of joyousness of it. And that there's something very similar in terms of what we're trying to offer in terms of your meditation practice, right? That there's going to be this baseline of mindfulness and concentration, right? Where you have, you know, Michelle has started to explain it a little bit and will, you know, explain more as makes sense. But that you have like these kind of very two basic frames around our attention. There are many more frames in this, but if you just think about these two, of that we have this kind of interest and capacity in concentration and interest and capacity around mindfulness. And understanding how they're different but related is very important. Right? That this basic process of bringing the attention to something, like bringing it to sound, bringing the attention to the body, bringing it to the hands, bringing the attention to the breath, that's called vitakka. That's like aiming, that's a, you know, Pali ancient word, aiming the attention. And then there's the process of sustaining the attention. So you bring the attention to sound, and you either try to keep it there at that sense door, or you just notice the sound of a bird, or the sound of the bell that Michelle did last night, and you try to keep the attention connected to it through its entire birth, life, and death. That's vichara. So you have vitakka and vichara, this aiming and sustaining of the attention through the rising and passing of any object, of a pain in the knee, of the rising of the breath, of the falling of the breath, of one lifting, moving, placing of the foot, of, you know, all these sort of manageable segments, these sort of small things that we're trying to kind of break the day into, of like not worrying about being mindful the whole day, but just can we bring aiming and sustaining to one object that's happening right now? And that's actually all we need to worry about, is what's arising and passing in our experience right now. And now that is incredibly hard. It is incredibly hard to aim and sustain the attention with anything. And then what's amazing and sometimes difficult is that that's not even mindfulness. That's just concentration. And that the mindfulness piece of like, well, okay, so as we're aiming and sustaining, what are we observing? What is it that we bear witness to? What do we notice about the textures, the tone, the changing qualities of what we're observing? That's this other quality of mindfulness. And they don't have to happen at the same time. You can have mindfulness without concentration. You can definitely have concentration without mindfulness. But there's a way that when they do come together, that they're incredibly powerful, that we actually have a chance to really witness life as it's unfolding in a much more precise and powerful way. And yet that doesn't happen most of the time. It was very clear to me. It was like 10 years of practice. And that's like weekend retreats, 10-day retreats, 10 years of like several three-month retreats, a couple month-long retreats, before I felt like I honestly could say I watched the full rising and falling of one breath. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I was like, I just saw a whole rising and falling of the breath. And it was just like, there was a 20-minute period where I was just a little more concentrated. And it was so funny for me to be like, gosh, you know, this thing that's felt like this huge thing over all these years, like follow the breath. And it was like, it's not even that important. It's not like I've been wasting my time for 10 years. I have had plenty of experiences of powerful mindfulness, of other phenomena in the mind, and of understanding of the amazing journey that we're on in terms of what's happening in the body and the mind. But it wasn't, I just hadn't had that degree of concentration where really through a whole rising and a full falling of the breath, there wasn't other thoughts or other sort of phenomena that arose. And so you, it's like really getting like, don't worry about it. You know, you try, yes, you're kind of doing this activity of trying to keep the attention concurrent with something, but that you can't have much expectation that you're actually gonna be concurrent. You know, you have to get that life is just wild. And like, there's a million things happening in a 5 second period and that we catch some of it. And what we catch is important. It's amazing to see. It's worthy of seeing. We can have powerful insights into the nature of reality without that degree of concentration. And so there's just this general sense of like, that opens up into, okay, you have this classical model of aiming and sustaining the attention, and then the mindfulness being brought to bear on that allows for insight. But in our kind of day-to-day practice reality, we have to get that, like, that's not, if we're putting too much pressure on ourselves, if the stakes feel so high around that, that we're forgetting to kind of enjoy ourselves, to be interested, to cultivate these other qualities of mind, or to appreciate that we're cultivating them in this endeavor, we can lose track of it, we can lose sight of it, and we can have less and less sense of our own capacity, right? Of like, oh, actually, I can do this. And that this is worthy and that it's interesting. If we're only evaluating ourselves based on an idea we have about how it might feel to be concentrated or what mindfulness is supposed to feel like, it's going to be a, you know, losing game of evaluation. Because that's the whole thing. It's like we're never going to be able to make life all pleasant. That the mindfulness, the liberation that comes from this process is like the incredible capacity of the mind to stretch and expand in its sense of peace and acceptance and love, no matter what conditions are present. So that when sleepiness arises, it's okay. We're not upset with it, we're not at war with ourselves. When restlessness arises, it's okay. We're genuinely interested. Oh, what's happening in the heart? What are these thoughts like? How does it feel like to have all this energy coursing through the body? Oh, that's unpleasant, you know? Or is it? What's the difference between being worried and being excited? Really? Like, if you really feel it in the body, how different do those experiences really feel? Or is it sort of a matter of, you know, some of the thought patterns that we're in and one or the other are different. And there's an association of one of those being pleasant or unpleasant. But really, how different are they? You know, it's this turning the attention inward and being curious about what's happening. And the mind not being so imprisoned by this very narrow bandwidth of what's acceptable and where we think happiness is. And actually that peace, that joy, that acceptance, and love, these tender qualities of the heart and mind can be more and more available in more and more of our experience because we're just more and more intimate with them. We understand them more fully. We're not threatened by them in the same way. A pain in the knee, you know, an unpleasant memory, a hope we have for the future, whatever. It's like all of these things, we come to explore them, and it doesn't always have to be in this sort of like technical kind of robotic way. Right, there's like different ways of approaching the practice that can be looser, be more relaxed, and exploring the range of like, well, what is it when we kind of ramp up the energy? What is it when we kick back on the energy? You know, how does that change the flavor of the mind? How does that change our interpretation of the experience? You know, during a period of intensive practice like you're in, giving yourself some permission to do that, right? To explore the range of ways that we might come into relationship with anything that's arising. Sometimes it's like leaning in and checking it out more closely. Sometimes it's backing off, giving it some space, checking out something else because it's too overwhelming, going to anchor in a different part of the body or in sound. Right, that versatility, that flexibility, it's like there's a a firmness of principle, but a flexibility of approach, right? So that you understand that the basic process is getting closer to life, getting closer to what's happening in the body and the mind and sound and hearing and smelling and tasting, all these experiences. But that how we're actually doing that and navigating this flood of experience in any given moment, there's a lot of flexibility. There's playfulness, right? We need to have some sense of how does this practice actually work for ourselves. The Buddha didn't just follow someone else's playbook. You know, he did train for many years along other people's methods and got very skilled in them and felt that they ultimately still weren't getting at the heart of what he was trying to liberate, trying to uproot in his mind, heart. And so he took those pieces of training and then he brought his own qualities to bear on that, right? His own intuitive sense of what might be helpful. There's a story about how he also was striving and pushing and he said trying to crush mind with mind, right? Till his teeth were clenched and he was sweating and, you know, he said he attained incredible concentration but then was, you know, exhausted and overrun with exhaustion and defeated by his inability to liberate the heart by trying to just shut it down. And then it said he remembered a time as a child where he was sitting under a rose apple tree and his father and other workers were in the fields preparing for harvest. And there was just this light breeze. And he remembered there was something so beautiful and peaceful about the gentleness of the shade and of the breeze and that he entered into very deep concentration as a child. And he thought, gosh, maybe that's the way. Maybe that's the way I should be practicing. Because there was something so beautiful in that that he remembered. And so that was his approach then was much softer, much more gentler, with still a lot of determination, with effort, but with this tenderness. And then this quality of mindfulness, of openness and acceptance of whatever is being seen. Not the managing of it, not the trying to shut certain things down. It's just like this tender quality of observation. It's a strength in incredible suppleness of being willing to witness and bear whatever is happening. That one framework that we find a lot of value in is these seven factors of awakening that the Buddha would speak about at times. And that this mindfulness was the first of them. This like the most important quality of this process of just this gentle yet powerful observational capacity of the mind. You know, that the mind can watch what's happening, that we can see what's happening in the body, we can see what's happening in the mind, that actually the mind is strong enough to observe itself and how amazing that is, and actually how light that must be and how fast that must be to be able to kind of keep up with it. And then from there, we have three energizing qualities and three calming qualities. There's investigation, energy, rapture, piti, and then there's calm, concentration, equanimity. And to really understand that like these are all beautiful qualities of the mind that are going to be there in degrees that are, you know, higher or lower depending upon conditions. But there are times where maybe we can kind of see that like, oh, you know, things feel okay, but maybe there's not a lot of investigation right now. And you can start to see that by this sort of just gentle move of the mind into a little bit more just interest into what we're seeing, what's happening, that energy starts to build. And from that energy building, there's a kind of engrossment that can come from that. That there's a way that by being interested, even in pleasant or unpleasant or neutral experience, of that willingness to not just have our opinions about it, but actually be curious about it, oh, that it builds energy and that that energy builds a kind of strength and momentum of mind that isn't so burdened by pleasant or unpleasant, that actually it can be just as interested in a pain in the knee as it is in a beautiful memory that we have. And that these are very powerful, energizing forces, and yet they also need to be kind of tempered by the calming forces of calm, concentration, equanimity. The sense of if we let that energy, you know, of the engrossment kind of fold back into the practice, that there's a smoothing out that happens. There's a calming of the mind. And there's a concentrating of the mind, this sort of more stillness, more sense of not being so resistant to the flow of experience. And then from that, a very powerful peace of mind that can arise, this acceptance of things as they are. And that, you know, at any given, you could spend your whole weekend just looking at these seven factors in any given moment. It's like, oh, right now, there's a lot of energy, but maybe not a lot of interest. Or there's a lot of energy, but not a lot of calm. Or, wow, it really feels like pretty equanimous. There's a sense of like stability of mind, you know, of this sort of acceptance and this peace is there. But there's also maybe a little low energy, sort of sleepiness. And so when that's happening for us, when you're just sleepy on the cushion and you feel like it's a problem, you know, can you tune in to those moments of being like, oh, well, there's calm. You know, that calm as this like genuine, beautiful factor of awakening. And can we appreciate that? Even though there's also not a lot of energy. Or when you're super restless and it's like all you want to do is run out the door, it's like, okay, there's not a lot of calm, but there's a lot of energy. And, you know, can I use this energy? Can I fold this energy back into the practice? Is there a way that I actually don't need to be afraid of it? Are we afraid or uncomfortable just because it's unfamiliar? You know, it can be like, okay, this feels kind of intense, but actually, I'll check it out. It's just what's happening. Maybe it's actually not as unfamiliar as we think, but we tend to tune out or avoid it in our lives. So these are all like just beautiful notes that are, you know, always available. And there might not always be happening at the same time, but sometimes you'll see like, oh, wow, this is when there's a lot of, you know, this kind of interesting balance between energy and calm. What does that sound like? You know, what does it feel like when there's mindfulness and energy and investigation? You know, what's that chord? And this sense of like really getting that, of course, there's times where all seven of those can come into balance for periods of time. And there's just like these beautiful harmonics to that. The sense of, wow, the incredible capacity of the mind when these forces come together. How we can be with this huge range of experience in the body and the mind without feeling threatened, without needing to run, without clinging. This sense of presence with a lot of stability. And, you know, just like in music, you know, when there's a musical tone, there are also these like harmonic overtones that happen with any note. I don't really understand why or how. It has to do with math. But like, you know, there's any wave that's getting created will have like resonant waves above it and or below it. And so there's a way that like by kind of, you know, any time we're developing mindfulness or we're developing energy, we're also evoking these other qualities of, you know, patience and determination, loving kindness, equanimity, wisdom, renunciation. You know, there are all these beautiful qualities that are being developed by us when we show up for our lives. You know, when we're present for what's happening in the heart, mind, body. And you see certain things are getting developed when it's a beautiful experience. You know, if you drop in and you're sitting and you feel so quiet, you know, there's like these beautiful qualities of the heart that you can feel and that you're generating the sense of appreciative joy, you know, of determination, of faith. And then when we're going through something hard, wow, the sense of forbearance, this quality. It's not just patience, but it's a kind of patience without expectation, right? We're developing different kinds of resiliency, of equanimity, by being willing to go through uncomfortable spaces in our hearts and minds. How beautiful that is. And I think it's important to remember actually how beautiful it is to be doing this together. You know, that it can be hard. You know, we're all trying to manage our minds and bodies in this space and this sort of different format and this process. And of course, there's so much about what's happening in each of our own individual minds and bodies that's difficult, or we just get impatient, or we're just like, okay, I'm done with this. And you know, or we're enthusiastic, and we're whatever it is that we're all going through, that we're in the space sharing it together, has its beauty and its challenges. And I just, you know, it was funny, the other day I was waiting in a car, and I heard somewhere someone practicing the piano, and it brought me back to my own childhood, where my mom had me taking piano lessons. And, you know, in similar ways that I was describing, of like, it was a challenge. It was like, I really liked being good at it when I felt good at it, and I really hated practicing it. Because that's mostly how you realize you're not good at it, or all the sense of inadequacy comes up when you're trying to learn these things, you know. But at some point, she signed me up for this music camp that I ended up going to in Maine, which was just not something that was like really part of my world. Definitely no one else I knew went to music camp. And it was hard for me on a number of levels of, you know, just how those things are, being away from home and in a sort of different social environment as like a 12-year-old. But I remember listening to this person practicing in the car. It reminded me of something I had forgotten for years about how this place was set up, where basically it was a big part of it was just like this sort of open area, these fields where there were just tons of little cabins, you know, these little ramshackle wooden cabins with like a couple windows, and each one had a piano. And people would just do all of their practicing in these cabins, whatever instrument they were playing. And so you could walk around and be like this kind of like, you know, beautiful summer day, and you would just hear all these people practicing their instruments. And it was so incredible, actually. And not to say that anyone sounded that good, right? I mean, some people obviously sounded very good, you know, and many of us didn't sound so good. But that wasn't the point, right? It wasn't like, oh, no one was performing. It was this space where everyone was there was like a public sense of practicing together. Now, we each had our own little rooms, but you had that sense of shared endeavoring, right? Of like, oh, there's other people who are at it, you know, and sometimes they're feeling success, and sometimes they're feeling hardship and frustration and agony and, you know, that there's like this huge range of emotion going on through this intention to be trying to just hit these right notes, trying to cultivate and hit these beautiful tones one after the other, learn these pieces, this sort of like rehearsing and being willing to be bad at it over and over again. And to be in the space where you could just hear that from all directions was something so beautiful, so powerful. And I remember going to high school after that and finding like that the practice rooms were all like in some dungeon, like in a, you know, soundproof, like at the far end of campus, you know. And the same in college, where I tried to play trumpet, where it was like, who you would never want to go to these rehearsal rooms because they're just like way at the far end and they're just dark and you're alone. And that sense of like, and it's like a cultural thing, right? Of like you practice alone until you're good and then you perform. And it's like, that's so bonkers, you know? And it's so uninspiring and so unhealthy. And this sense of like, what is it actually to be practice together and to be messy together and to not be totally with it together and be trying together though. The sense of shared humanity and the space of shared endeavoring around that is something that I just value so much in terms of this type of space. As hard as it can be. You know, there are times I know where we're like, oh, if everyone else was gone, it'd be much easier, you know, if I just had my own little dungeon room somewhere. And you know, there might be times where that's true. But all in all, there is something very important to remember about this thing around spiritual friendship and what is the kind of love and appreciation we can have for each other that actually are inspiring of seclusion, inspiring us to, that show us our own places of still entanglement, you know, because that's a lot of what we experience from one another. I mean, if most of your experiences with one another here are just like love, like that's awesome, you know, that's great. And that's rare. You know, most people on retreat at some point start to come up against the edges of frustration with other people's behavior, you know, and it's, we start to see on one hand, there is that sense of like our behavior actually does have impact. And that we are responsible for that. And that we should be as careful as we can with each other in this space. But also it puts us up against our own pettiness. You know, our own sense of like how controlling the mind, how we think happiness is about controlling other people's behavior. It's like, if your happiness is dependent upon other people's behavior, you're never going to be happy. Right? That's just like basic math. And so then where is the happiness that might be beyond that? Where is the sense of freedom and peace of mind and heart that isn't actually dependent upon other people's behavior or our interpretation of it? How do we use the challenges and the sort of dissonance that might arise in our observations, in our silent presence with one another? How do we use that as not a way to keep dumping our projections on everyone else, right or wrong. We may have a right idea about someone's behavior, but it doesn't matter. In this context, it's always going to be, look at yourself. Look at your own wanting. Look at your own aversion. You know, look at what is it about your own heart, your own mind, that is suffering because of someone else's behavior that has nothing to do with you, and how much we might be doing that during a day. Or if it's not judgment, it's you know, it can be the other way around, judging ourselves, thinking everyone else here knows what they're doing and everyone else looks so good and like they're perfect yogis and I'm like the worst yogi. And just again, it's the same. It's the same process of like, wow, how are we interpreting this stuff as a reflection of ourselves? And to be careful with that, to be tender with ourselves around that, to understand that that's just imagination in the mind. And at any moment, we can drop the attention back into the body, into the emotional world, into the mind, you know, into what's happening right now. And that's always going to be the encouragement. Keep looking. What is, you know, this practice, this the subtlety, this the capacity of mind to see things in such clarity that's so different than our normal way is incredible, right? That we actually can follow sound as it's happening. We can follow thought as it's happening. We can follow experiences that are happening. The mind has this ability to observe phenomena as they arise, exist, and pass away. And how amazing it is, because what it starts to see are these kind of classical insights. That all things are changing, right? Everything is impermanent. And because of that, there's an undependability to things. Everywhere we're trying to create solidity and stability, is going to fail because things are always changing. They're of the nature to arise and pass based on conditions. And that actually includes even this thing we call ourselves. This sense of me-ness is also the result of constantly changing conditions. And so you see why this is hard. It's like those three insights into the nature of phenomena, they're not in and of themselves like super inspiring, right? It's like everything's changing, everything's undependable, and there's not even a coherent self, right? It's like, awesome, that's great, you know? But that sense of like, no, okay, and that's why we're suffering, because we want that stability so much. We want predictability. The heart longs for that sense of things to just be the way we want them to be. And that's not crazy. It's beautiful, but it's also painful. And that through this process, there is a beautiful and liberating disenchantment that comes. The sense of, oh, the mind just gets that things are unfolding as they unfold. The more we watch sleepiness, the more we watch the pain in the knee, the more we watch these beautiful states of mind like joy, peacefulness arise, right? And we see them change because of conditions. There's a deepening equanimity, peace, stability, and tenderness of heart that's actually beyond conditions. That there's a capacity that grows that doesn't need things to be a certain way to be happy or to be loving, to be compassionate. That there's a freedom that's in the insight, through the insight, that is beyond conditions. And yet it's only through that process that we go through it. That we come to understand more of those places. There's a there's another sutta. The Buddha says, suppose there was a king or a king's minister who had never heard the sound of a lute before. He might hear the sound of a lute and say, what, my good men, is that sound? So delightful. So tantalizing, so intoxicating, so ravishing, so enthralling. They would say, that, sire, that's called a lute, whose sound is so delightful, so tantalizing, so intoxicating, so ravishing, so enthralling. Then he would say, go and fetch me that lute. And they would fetch the lute and say, here, sir, here is the lute, whose sound is so delightful, so tantalizing, so intoxicating, so ravishing. So enthralling. He would say, enough of your lute, just fetch me the sound. Then they would say, this lute, sire, is made up of numerous components, a great many of components. It's through the activity of numerous components that it sounds. That is, dependence on the bridge, on the body, on the skin, on the neck, on the frame, on the strings, and the appropriate human effort. Thus it is that this lute, made of numerous components, a great many components, sounds through the activity of numerous components. And then the king would split the lute into 10 pieces, 100 pieces. Having split the lute into 10 pieces, 100 pieces, he would shave it into splinters. Having shaved it into splinters, he would burn it into a fire. Having burned it in a fire, he would reduce it to ashes. Having reduced it to ashes, he would winnow before a high wind or let it be washed away by a swift flowing stream. He would say, a sorry thing, this lute, whatever a lute may be, by which people have been so thoroughly tricked and deceived. In the same way, monk, investigate form, however far form may go. Investigate feeling, perception, mental fabrications, consciousness, however far consciousness may go. As you investigate form, feeling, perception, fabrications, consciousness, however far they may go, any thoughts of me or mine or I am do not occur to us. And so there is this process, right, of understanding this instrument of the mind and of the body's relationship to the mind. And that we're just taking it into smaller and smaller pieces, smaller and smaller segments, starting to see what is it about it that enchants us, that tantalizes us, or that, you know, horrifies us, or that scares us. and that we have this very slow and careful process of trying to, you know, tenderly understand, like, what is it? What is the nature of this being, of this becoming that we're so involved in? And that actually, through that process, we become liberated from whatever enchantment or intoxication we might feel, but that it's a beautiful enchantment, that disenchantment that we come to, right? This peace of not being so fascinated with the fabricated and actually at peace with reality, with what's happening in the body, with what's happening in the mind and all the senses. So there's just this, like, just, you know that at the end of a first day of a retreat, you cannot evaluate yourself, right? You can't, it's like, if you're still here, A+, right? Like, that is the evaluation. Like, you're still here. Oh, no, don't go. No. A-. No, just kidding. Huh. You know, that's perfect. You know, to know that it is bewildering. It is uncomfortable. It's unfamiliar terrain, and to know that, like, the more unfamiliar it feels, the more bewildered we feel the happier we are. Right? The more we feel like, yes, you're doing it, you know? And to understand that, of course, there's times you want to come back to more security, more sense of who you are, and who are all these other people, and what are you doing in your life, and what are you doing here? And, you know, like, of course, those thoughts arise, and you can entertain them, you know? But try to watch yourself entertain them. Try to watch that sense of sort of stability and security that we feel when we come back into this imagined solidity that we keep trying to shore up, and feel some compassion for ourselves. Feel like it's like, of course we have that sense of needing that space, that care, that tenderness, that sense of familiarity and safety. But that also, like, once we sort of give the heart that, right? Once there's a sense of like, okay, like, we're not going to just push ourselves, like, so far beyond our capacity. We're going to let ourselves come back into safety. But that from that place of strength, then it's like, okay, we explore again. We're willing to let go of some of the thoughts and the sort of incessant pattern of perspective on things, and be willing to see things freshly. Be willing to you know, be bad at playing this instrument, because we're learning, right? To understand that it's like the learning that feels meaningful, not just hitting the right notes. And so just, you know, as you kind of go in, you know, through today and into tonight and into tomorrow, just have that sense of patience with yourself and with one another, you know, just to, again, it's like that sense of appreciating that we're all trying, you know, we're all trying our best. And, you know, for humanity, that isn't always that great looking, you know. And so we have to have a lot of, like, compassion. Right, of being like, gosh, it's so hard to be human. It's so hard to be in these minds and these bodies with our histories, our, you know, like, our lives. There's a powerful range of joy and sorrow that we have the capacity for. And it's very hard to navigate that. And that we're trying. And that we're willing to do that in a semi kind of public way is very courageous. And to know, like, when you need to take space, when you need to, you know, get a little bit more sense of protection in your room or outside, that's okay. And also to see, like, how amazing it is actually to try to share space and protect space for one another. Right? So that sense of also getting that we do have an impact on one another, and that we're careful about that. You know, we're trying to be as careful of what we might be evoking as possible. Some of that's about, like, this space. And really, it's like, if you're in the hall, you know, trying to stay in the hall through the sitting, unless there's a real emergency that we get as we get more and more sensitive. You know, one person walking out, another person walking out, things can start to feel, like, unstable in a way that can threaten the sense of the protectiveness of the container. And so just that sense of like, if you come into the sitting, just, you know, try your best to be here through the whole period. If you have to open your eyes and not be sort of doing intensive practice, that's fine. But that sense of it, or maintaining the silence, you know, that's with, of course, with the people you don't know, because you don't know what anyone is going through. You don't know what emotion, what memory, what challenges people might be in the midst of processing and dealing with. You have to be very tender and respect each other's space. And then even more so in times with the people you do or might know. Right? So not like wandering off together. The sense of like, you know, if a couple's go off, it's like there's that sense of, you might not appreciate how evocative that might be. Right? That people are trying to hold the container, trying to be in silence. And the sense of like people going off laughing, enjoying one another. It's like how it brings up so much for people about how they miss their partner and maybe they should go home, or they haven't had a partner in so long, or the last partner they had, or whatever, right? It's like just to know that like we're trying to do this together, and that there actually are ways of protecting the space and honoring each other's challenges in it that are real and powerful and beautiful. And the more we feel that sense of comradeship and camaraderie in this process, the more we're taking care of ourselves and one another in that space, the more we'll all benefit from it. You'll feel good about having protected the space. You'll feel good feeling people have helped protect that space. It's like it's a goodness that doesn't run out. So whatever happens with the conditions over the next 5 minutes, never mind overnight and into the morning, just remember that it's like we try our best and that ultimately we are responsible for bearing the intensity of our own minds and hearts and bodies, responsible for our own actions mentally, verbally, physically, and that we try to show up for whatever comes up, whatever is evoked, try to bring as much tenderness and care and as much clarity as we can. So we have about half an hour for walking and a metta chant at 9 o'clock. You can practice your tuning. See you soon.